Ag Josephine Kelleher.
Agus
tá mé an hogad buige go leor sean scéaltaí a stramísan Josephine agus an paraiste míhe agus tá trí ggéalaithe cí a tá sí muíos cléirtú so ceitim go dáiseama den ggéalaithe déan go le bailí frí tú gang mé muid a bogann an go dtín beirla as gomó tá trí sean scéaltaí agus a scarapaí Josephine agus ceitim Tasha to Kabin be train almost me too, because Tasha to be can Shanskill is me that Tasha they chose me.
Well, Nellis Agumudi, this Macantia did that Kedeba Kibab be here took Jaham a Mahan Wallace.
Shouldn't tell you.
Yes, Chamber baby. Well, Pa, my smooth you at and Glory goes out to the Egma, where. Wado angelic and yen tra the echo. Agus Jerry Shigoni glor alto agus buia hasto yea honan tra sho agus ahan tra ele a war megan alto glor alto agus buia hasto yea. For shisha bas duravishi kera score agus kera biena agus fua shibas an kera lade ebrin agus dur chilien nien an la revision as moor an trua ye vee mo jagola shule nes agus an am shul moi ha ha a choku yeah dur chishan dur chishan dur agus an shen Mwere wana vi orhe. Agus vi ni Jennifer Eki hu huegu kashla na duha. Vere mishe an skeel shan an berla.
Well, I'm just an skeel shan an berla. It's coming
up. Well, her sister was taken or went to do castle when Charles Vaughan Hart was there. This was never recorded or never written about what I'm going to tell you now. She was a very, very beautiful girl, so I would say she was probably lifted and taken on account of her beauty, and maybe there might have been bug payments to be made that weren't paid. I don't know which was that.
And what was her name?
Her name was Sal Cannon. Sal Cannon.
Sal Cannon, right.
Yes, Sal Cannon. And she was at the castle, and she wasn't a servant or a slave or anything like that. She would be out with the men who would drive the two black horses over to Lacca to collect the salmon. And he respected her very well. And it's only lately I discovered that he was a pretty elderly man at this time and wanted to marry her. But she was a Catholic and he was not, so that didn't come off. And I don't know how many years she was there, but there was a child. Now, and all I know is that there was a ship docked in at the castle, and the selling satins and stuff like that from the Far East. And there was sailors, of course, and men on the ship, and they would come in the castle and they would sometimes dine in the castle. So this fellow got very interested in Sal Cannon, and he knew she had this child, and between them they made a plan that he would steal her off on the ship, and she was stolen off to America, baby and all. And she married the man, and the name of the child was, wait a minute now, she called him then, you see, for the husband, and name was, the child was Leslie Ellis. Now, or the man, I'm not sure which, that the man that she married was Leslie Ellis. But some years ago to this village, maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, somebody came, I never heard about him, by the name of Hart, who wanted to know, was there any Harts in Creasley, and nobody sent them to me. So he went away again, and he was gone a long time before I knew. But Sal came home, and when he died, the man died after several years, and she came home an old lady, and nobody could understand how she could live so well, but she had a British pension from her sailor husband. Isn't that amazing?
That is some story.
That's some story, and that is fact. Now, I can tell you another story about another few about old people. My, wait, now I have to think, would it be my great-granny's grandfather and his wife, and I can't give any dates, but it's a very long time ago, because it was long before the chapel in Carrigart was built, and it's built 120 or 30 years now, and it was built before the cathedral in Letterkenny, so it was built a long time, and the men came down from Armagh to do the cut stones to build the chapel in Meva. And anyhow, these people had he was Neddy McBride was his name, I don't know his wife's name, and they had six children, and at certain stages in their life all the children died, and they had no children left after having six. So they went over to the chapel in Carrigart, which was away down past where the chapel is now. It was a little thatch hut place down where there's a bit of an old cemetery. It was down there, and it was thatch, and they went to the priest, and I don't know his name, and they told him the story, what would they do? And he read his brief, not his bravery, the other book that they have with his prayers and for everything. And he read this for a very long time, and he closed it like that. And he said, there's only one thing you can do. You'll have to name all your children from the Old Testament. And right enough, the first son came along, and they called him Abel. And the next same son came along, and they called him Cain. Right? It's a very long time ago, it's before this was schools allowed. So Cain was taught to read and write. I don't know about Abel, but Cain was taught to read and write. And it was when Australia was discovered. And the only way they was going to Australia was convicts. But there was a report of a ship going to go from Derry to Tilbury Docks, I think we called it. London, I think it was Tilbury Docks. And the ship was to sail to Australia. And they decided, Cain decided he would like to go to this place that was called Australia. So they gathered the money for the passage. And have you any idea how much the passage was? Well, I know. It was £2, £3.60. And that is true. Now, they had the money already, and that was some gathering. But I think it was only about fourpence a day men got at that time. And anyhow, he left. And would you believe me, from that day to this, nothing was ever heard of Cain McBride. And I have a notion that myself I will write to Australia House, because when I have the knowledge that the fair, I think it was the first paid passage that went to Australia, and I think I'll write and see if they have any account of him. But it's possible that he could have been robbed before he got there, if people knew that he had money. But that could be a far-fetched story, yeah. I don't know. So that's all I know. Except that some people from Australia came to the home where my great granny came out of. They came maybe 30 or 40 years ago. They were McBride, but whether there were anything to do with that, the people who were there then didn't inquire. And there was other people came who were not McBride, but they told about getting a newspaper from Ireland with a seed of a tomato sticking on the Sunday paper, you know, and they planted the seed and they had tomatoes growing. That's that story. That's the end of that story. We'll have to finish that story when we find out from Australia House in London.
Right, yeah.
I will try that. I will. I have
it. Well, seeing that we're on Doncaster, you have a lot more stories about Lord Leitrim.
Well, not very many, because he was a very cruel man. And he had a lot of land away up, far up, in different counties to here. And there was a swap went on from the Stuart Bams estate, but that's more recent. The Stuarts owned Ard's house, you see, and it goes back a good bit. I'll not be able to tell you the names of the people, but the one man who owned it, he was very proud and he thought it was wonderful, and he would decide to make a road from Letterkenny, a new road rather than coming in Glen. There used to be no road, and he made this road and he bankrupted himself, and then he went away and the place was sold and two people bought it, and then after they got and the difficulties about money, they sold it and went. So the stewards bought it, and there was no heir, only a lady, and she married a man called Bam, and he was from South Africa, and he was rather kind, because in South Africa you would not be cruel to white people. You see, you were only cruel to coloured people. And they didn't think it was cruel in those days. They thought that these people didn't know anything at all. Terrible thinking. And Stuart Bam then had a big staff there, and they would have balls and everything like that. So they sold out there eventually, and they went to County Down first, and then, oh no, let me forget another bit. They went to Scotland. And I was over in England, and I met this lady on the train when I was going over, and she was in the Third Order like myself, but she lived down in Sutton in Surrey. And she said, come down, and I did, went down after a few days. I went down for a weekend to see the lady, and she was a beautiful lady, and she was a teacher, and so was her husband. And she said, he's more qualified than me, but he teaches retarded children, but I just teach ordinary children. And he asked me about Ireland, and he knew nothing at all about Ireland, so I was telling him about big house in Ards and that, and I said, the Stuart Bams. She said, that's very strange that you should say that about Stuart Bams. He said, before that, his wife said to me, say a prayer for my niece. She's taken up with people that's not suitable. And I said, oh, I'm very sorry to hear that. And she said, we're praying in the Franciscan order that she'll come to her senses, because she's not suitable. She said, those people is not suitable. And I said, what kind of people are they? Oh, she said, lords. And I know the name, she named the lords, family and that. And she said, she shouldn't be with them. They should be on their own. But he said, I knew about that first. And then he said, well, is that so funny that this Stuart Bam's daughter, this father on now, was very friendly with my wife's niece, he said. And he said, when the war broke out, the Stuart Bam, I don't know what they call them now, but they're still Stuart Bam, her father, this girl's father, who was friendly with my wife's niece, decided she needed a bicycle, but there weren't any bicycles, so he wrote to the Triumph and he wrote to Raleigh, thinking he might get one, and he got two. And his wife pipes up, yes, she says, and I got the odd one. She says, my niece got it, and she didn't want it, and she gave it to me in the South, and she had none of you want to see it. Not a good story.
That's a
good story. And that's all I know about that. But they were.
You had the last day, Josephine, you were talking about when Lord Leitrim was killed. You had a story about a man going to.
Oh, yes, I remember that, yes. Well, it was supposed to be, but I don't know whether that's true or not. So far, anything I've told you is pure truth. There was a story about this man who was one of the people who killed him, and the way they found out, some of them, the things that they packed, the paper they packed the muskets with, was from the school, and the school children's writing was on it, and that's how they found some of the men that killed him. But anyhow,
do you remember their names?
Oh, I was never told.
No.
Oh no, you couldn't be told that.
No.
Oh no.
They wouldn't tell the children at the time.
Oh no, they wouldn't tell anybody. No, I mean, anyway. But this one particular man got away, and he got to America. And he had two addresses. One was in New York City, and the other was someplace in California. I'll not tell you exactly where, but it was out in the west anyway. And he went to the address in New York City, and when he went in, it was a public house, and everybody's head turned and looked at him, and he got such a fright, he thought everybody knew him, so he felt the guilt, and he went out, and he walked all the way 3,000 miles, but worked on farms along the way till he went to California.
And he settled there.
Oh, he settled there. That's what I heard. He settled there, and the person who was there, who was already there, knew him and knew who he was and his people and that, and he fixed him up. That's the way the people did in those days, you know.
Yes.
And I was out myself in California not so long ago, and my son-in-law took me through the Donner Pass. I wonder if you ever heard of the Donner Pass. It's so sad. It makes me cry even now. A very big train, you know what you call going to the West, going to California. They prepared so well. They had everything, and there was a very big train wagon, a lot of wagons and all, and they prepared very well. And they prepared so well that it took them slower to go. And when they got this place, there was a murder. A man killed somebody, and they banished him. You can't be with the train. So they banished him, and he went on by himself, right? And before they got out of this valley, mountains, snow came down, and they were there for the whole winter. And they nearly all died, horses, dogs, everything. And the cannibals, some of the people, but not all of them. But anybody who survived, the only man that went and told that there was the man that murdered. And he brought help. And only for that, they would never got out. Yes, and it was so sad. And even the ones that cut through then, they could never say they were there, because they would say, oh, you're cannibals. But they weren't all, but they had to pretend something else altogether, and they lived a terrible life. Wasn't that sad?
Sad.
And they prepared too well. And a man told me, I was talking to a man, and he said, it's a funny thing, the way that the trail they made to get to the West, out through the Rocky Mountains and all that, the trail that they made when the engineers came to build roads were very little distance off the trail that the ordinary people made. Was that amazing?
Oh, that's amazing.
Yes.
Josephine, we'll go back to your youth while we growing up. How were things in it?
How was it? Well, I was the youngest of a large family. My eldest sister was married 2 years before I was born. And if she had hurried up and have children, they'd be older than me, but she was almost 3 years married before she had any children. And then, God bless her, she had 10 sons and 5 daughters. And so I was kind of spoiled in the sense that my father was very good to me, and so was everybody else. But it was, if you thought it was hard, but if you didn't think it was hard, it wasn't. We worked a lot on the land. The schools didn't open till the 7th of September. Because the children were needed at home to gather the potatoes, take home the turf, make the straps and lift the corn. And
you did all of it?
Oh, I did all of that, yes. But then the thing about it was, what was I going to say? The thing about it was, everybody was the same, and it made no difference.
None at all,
and it was very, very happy. And we hadn't enough of land. We had plenty wild land, but we only had maybe, I don't know, many acres of arable land. But my father was an excellent farmer, and my mother was a very good one behind him to have things ready, because I remember when the thrashing would come, there was a thrashing mill under Mason Sheridan's, and a thrashing mill, and they would take over a stack of corn. And I remember being over on the top of the thing, breaking the straps, handing them the sheaves to the man who was feeding the mill. And then he would spread it out like that, and it would go into the mill, and another one. You had to hurry up and have it on the time. And of course, before that, it was that we were away. My father would take land for more, and away
over. He would rent it.
11 months, you rent always. You would take it. You would say you would just take it for 11 months, and you owned it for 11 months. And if you owned it any longer, then you would have a claim.
Right.
So you had it for 11 months, and we took for potatoes, and we took for corn, and 1 year we took for lint. Maybe you don't know what lint is.
No,
I'll tell you what lint is. It's flax, and it's what they make the linen from. It's a mess. It's beautiful growing in the field. You never see anything. It's completely blue, the most beautiful blue blossoms, and it was gorgeous. Cornflower blue would be the name of the blue. And we had it right over there beside where the big hotels, and that's going to be built now on the golf course on this side of Kerrigan, past Snagga. And the field there, so you wouldn't cut it, you would pull it. And you would pull this and pull it up by the roots, and then you would make stooks of it till it was dry. And when it was dry, you took it then and you steeped it, and pull that was not running. It would be sort of banged up the way that it would stay still. And you left it there for 9 days. And then you lifted it out of that when it was rotten. And you never smelt anything like it. My father would, you're not to lift that, it's too heavy. And I couldn't lift that, but oh, it was terrible. And then what you do, you had to dry it again. And when it was dry again then, the centre of the stalks was what was rotten. What was on the outside round the stalks was the lint, which was the flax.
Yeah.
And that was sent away to a scotch mill to look. Scotch the inside out of it and keep the stuff on the outside to make the linen threads and linen
where,
cloth.
And where was the Scotch
man? Oh, I think it was far from here. I think it was past the ban.
Right.
But there would be somebody would come and collect it when it was dry, and they would examine it to see was it long, was the stalks long enough, you see, to make the thread, they'd be nice and long. And funny enough, I was working in the north when I was very young, and Newton Stewart, and the man had a very big farm, and he had what you call cotter houses on the land where his labourers worked. And I went over to visit the cotter house one night, and I never saw anything like the fire that they had. They had this fire, and it was like, do you know now what you see made now, the timber things that they're making for, actually very new, they're making timber things now for making, for burning and stoves. And well, it looked like that, like small bits
small
of...
Splinters,
small splinters? No, it was stuff, it was like about a half an inch long and never more than an inch and maybe a quarter of an inch. Nice creamy stuff. And what was it? It was what was inside the flax that was rotten and dried again.
So they used that for
They used fire. That for firing. And do you know how they put the fire down? They put a plank, you know, it would be a round thing like a branch of a tree, about 12 inches in diameter, about 6 inches, you know, wide. And they put one piece sitting down like that, flat on the hearth, and at the very back they put another one standing up. And they built this tight, round doll, and they had it right up about 18 inches. And all then up at a slope to the back. And then they lifted out the two pieces of timber or branches of wood, and they put a match to it, and it went, whoosh, and went up like that, and the hole where the flat one was, and up the back. And that got redder and redder, and slowly, they were able to bake their pan bread on that, you know, a pan with no lid on it. And
a flat kind of a pan.
A flat kind of a pan, quite a big one, bigger than the ovens that they used to bake the oven bread in. And
it threw out great heat, this fact.
This stuff was marvellous. You'd have to keep pulling back your chair. You'd get too warm.
Yeah.
And I was in there from the 12th of November to the 12th of May. And it was lovely. I was working in a house, and it was...
But hold on, this is where you first went.
That's the first place I went to work.
So did you go to the rabble?
I went to the rabble first.
And then began
it? Yes, stole away. I never told I was going.
You just went off.
Yeah, and my sister, she was 2.5 years older than me.
And what age were you, Joseph?
Well, let's see, 15. I, that was November. I had been 15 in January. So this was November. And I met a man, and my sister, I said, are you going to hire, really? I don't know. I said, we'll see.
And so off you went just to...
On the bus. I'd take some stuff with me, but I'm sure, without knowing it, I'm sure my mother was awake and headed. But it was double summertime, you see. In the wartime, it was double summertime in the summertime, and it was summertime in the wintertime.
So this was the wartime. What year would that be?
Suppose it would have been with, you see, 1941. And this big dark haired man looked at me and he said, do you for hire? And I looked at him and I got the shivers in my back, and I said, no, I'm not. He was scary. You looked at his eyes and you kind of knew.
Yeah.
I found out I was dead right, but I got the shivers in my back. I had a special thing in my back always. When anything was dangerous, I would get a shiver down my back for no reason, even if the sun was shining. But anyway, another wee man came and he had a helmet on like that, and there were two flaps on the ears, and he had a moustache exactly like my father, and he was ever so nice. And he said, are you looking for work? A different approach, it seems, but I didn't notice that at the time. And I said, I am. And he said, what can you do? I said, I can do everything. And wasn't I cheeky too when I come to think of it? I didn't know to be scared of him. I didn't know the how you treat an employer, because I never was employed. And he said, can you milk? And I said, I can. And can you churn? I can. Can you make butter? I can. Can you bake? I can. Can you wash? I can. Can you iron? I can. And sort of, I thought, it's an awful lot of questions, and I thought he should know that, if you know what I mean, when I was looking for work. And I suppose I looked at him out, while I'm asking you, he said, there's no woman in the house. Oh, thank God, says I, this is great. No boss
again. Nobody to argue with.
That's right, or nobody to tell you, do this and do that. I knew I could do everything, and I was a strong girl, you know. Anyhow, we got into this lovely cab, beautiful Humber Hawk with a beautiful smell of pure leather and lovely front with wood in it, and it was gorgeous.
So what deal did you make with him then?
Oh, yes, he asked. Oh, that's right, I forgot that. He asked me, how much do you want? Well, as far as I knew at that time, it was £18 for 6 months, plus your keep. And I thought...
So you demanded that? Like?
No, I didn't. I said, he said, how much do you want? I said, £26.
Oh, Jesus.
He said, well, I said, £1 a week. I thought £1 a week would be, you know. And I knew I needed the money. And, well, I suppose there was nobody else there suitable, maybe. But he took to me and I took to him. It was as simple as that. And he was just like my father. And I just treated him the same as my father. And I was as good to him and he was as good to me as could be. And went.
So off you went to Newton Stewart, was
it? Off and went to Newton, outside Newton Stewart, right. Past Bessie Bell. There was a mountain there called Bessie Bell, and we passed that. And I went to work in the house, and there was his daughter, the same age as me, who was at secondary school, and his son, I'm not telling you any names. I'm not telling you the address either, because that wouldn't be fair. And he was a lovely man, and his wife was not dead. She was in hospital. Right. We'll leave that partic there. But, well, not say her name either. The daughter was absolutely beautiful, and she had red wavy hair, and a big kitchen, two big wonders, a radio, just exactly what I find. Music while you work was on that time, 12:45 to 1 o'clock. All the factories would have music while you work during the war, and it was all the whatever songs was in date then, coming round the mountains when she comes, and all that was lovely. And I said to, there was this one on, making American Beauty of a Sweet Irish Rose Like You. And I said to the daughter this day, I said, that might happen to you, Nimina. Oh, she said, it couldn't happen to me. And I said, why not? She said, I'm not Irish. And I said, were you born in England? And she said, no, I was born here. Well, if you were born here, you're Irish. That was the identity crisis that lived on to this very day.
It still does.
And the poor, well, the ancestors. Mm-hmm. Well, if you go to, if you matter what country you go to, you have to be the be of that country.
If you were born there, yeah.
Aye, certainly. Or even if you went to America, you have to be American. You can't be Irish American. But they have, you know. And then somebody else said, we're talking about somebody else, and said, well, if I was born in a stable, it wouldn't be a horse. No, I said, our Lord wasn't a horse either. We had well fun, you know, we had very good fun.
Yes.
And then there was an excursion going down to Saban, a bus. So this fella, James, not my name, any names, you go to the excursion, I can't afford it, I'll take you, it's only half a crown. Took me down, and I had saved out of the rations a wee packet of tea, right? Because I had the tea and I got the rations and everybody got their tea, but if there were a spoonful left, when the new tea came in, I put that by. So I had a wee packet of tea left and I thought, I'll take this down, so I put it down here. And man said, this man that took me down, and a very nice man, what height are you? 6'1" and a half. Half was very important, you see, nothing, 6'1" was not, 6'1" and a half, that was, but anyhow, took me down, and he said, I'll take you across, I know somebody in this public house who goes down your way, and he did know somebody, and I had the parcel ready, and gave it to the man, and the man sent it home. No, he brought it down to my sister, who worked a certain place, not well far from here, as you know, and She came down to my mother and she said, that tramp, she said, going about in pubs, she said, up in the north. And I got into terrible trouble about doing a good turn. But anyway, that was that. It was a laugh. And that was that. So we finished there. And shall I tell you about the... he was a lovely...
You spent 6 months there?
I spent 6 months there. Mm. And then he said, would I stay on? And I said, no, I'm sorry. And he said, don't let money take you away. In other words, he would give me whatever I asked. But he did give me... While I was there, I said, I need £3. What do you need £3 for? I said, it's getting cold in the wintertime, and you're called at 10 to 6 to go out to milk. Do you understand?
10 to 6.
But he was up before that, and out and had the udders of the cows washed.
How many cows would you milk?
Four each. We all had four.
Four each.
And if one of them went dry, that was your luck. You know, it wasn't bad. And he was a lovely man. He was so good to me. You have no idea. I got to church one Sunday and they got to church the next Sunday, or the other one.
Yeah.
And there was ducks and hens, and there was water and a big tank outside which was pumped up from away down, so hot and cold water and everything like that. And I'll say no more about that now, but it was very good and I enjoyed it. And I came home and I wanted to work in a shop.
You wanted to?
Yes, I did. Mm. My mother knew from before I went to school I used to be always making the shop with the little pieces of tin and pieces of delf and things like that.
You just like that, you know?
Yes, and my mother was very wise, and for her time of life, she didn't want any of her daughters to be dependent on a man to keep them. She wanted them to have, and shall I tell you where she learned that? When she was a young girl. Now, she was born in 1881, and this was in 1800 and something, for she was married at 19 and a half. So this must have been in 1890 sometime. She was working in a dairy. And she would take the baby to the park in the afternoon, and there was this gentleman used to admire the baby, and where you from? She named the house she was from, Mrs. So-and-so, and he understood that she was a relation of Mrs. So-and-so, and he was home from India, and he told her a lot of things, and she was very interested in India. And he said, and what relation are you, after 2 or 3 days talking, what relation are you to Mrs. whatever her name was? And, oh, she said, I'm no relation, I just work there. Oh, he says, what a pity, what a shame. And he walked away. And she thought, I'll never let that happen to any of my girls. I'll live to be independent, not have to be working for somebody. So what I wanted to do, she had 2 daughters, nurses, and the other one got married, and what else? I went to the shop.
Which shop did you go to?
Dublin.
To Dublin?
Dublin. Yeah. Advertisement in the paper. I wanted trainee shop assistant. Must be a farmer's daughter. Fee £20. So my mother came up with me, and the fee was £20. You had to pay for the privilege of working for nothing for 2 years training. That was what was known as your apprenticeship.
So was this a drapery shop?
Not at all. No. It was 3 small grocery shops, grocery and dairy. The milk you would measure out. Well, I had good experience with that at Newton Stewart, because I was selling the milk there. And, you know, from the dairy. And, I will not go into it. There were so many flies, it would make you sick. The shop was here, and we'll say you went in the door, that was the shop. You went in the next place, and that was with the dining room. And then the next place in beside that was the living room. But the dining room was small, and there were flies. And I never got over the flies. If you see, there's not one fly in this house. Look about.
No.
Not one. I have a thing against them, and they can't live. No, they can't live.
You banished them.
I banished them. If I see a fly, I go after them. Till I find them. And anyhow, you have to go after them behind them. There's no good in going in front of them, because they have eyes all round, you know. The flies, they can see every way. So if you're at the very back and be very quick, you can get them like that. But anyway, I stayed there for a year and a bit.
And no. Did you settle at all, Joseph?
Oh, I settled very well, because all the other girls would come that worked in the other two shops. They would come and they all lived at home. They all lived in the house there.
Right.
And I had the one bedroom to myself. And
what part of Dublin was this?
Well, it was North Central.
Right.
Very central. And then the other shops was up off Gohanel Street, and another one was, well, I seen it, where the other one was, dang it, I forget now. One in Benburb Street, one in Bridgeford Street, and one in Sean McDermott Street. Slum places. And then, you're all right, I'm not touching it.
Oh, yeah.
You would get up in the morning. I was no time there then when I had to open the shop at 6. Go and open the shop at 6, and we had to take over 200 players and 200 small cigarettes, players' weights or something, 400 cigarettes and the change. And then you worked from 6, and there was a queue at 6 when you went over there. That was the
people going to work at the
No. The women out for the breakfast, for the men coming in from work.
Right.
Coming off work.
Right.
And for the cigarettes and for the milk and what else. And you would get that done, and then you had to fill every gallon of milk you sold. There was a quarter of a penny tax on it for the government, and so you had to enter in the book whatever much milk you sold. But I never entered what I drank, because I left the house with nothing to eat, and you got the breakfast at 10 o'clock. You see, you could take whatever you wanted out of the shop, so I took cornflakes and I suppose the top of the cream, because a gallon, 10 gallons of milk, and I came home.
But you were right, because how could you go on working?
No, you couldn't. No. So I'll tell you how the working arrangements was. If you got up at 6, you went over and you worked at 10, you come back for your breakfast when the other girl came over at 10 to let you off. You come back from your breakfast, you went back again then, and you let her off to her lunch, and then you went for your lunch at 2 o'clock, and you were off from 2 to 4. That was your time off. And then you worked on round to 10 o'clock again. You see. So it was 12 for 16-hour day.
Yeah.
But you didn't work the 16
no,
hours.
No.
No. But you were 2 hours off. But really, it was your dinner time, really.
It was.
Yeah. But then,
did you do that for 7 days?
No. Then the next day, you didn't come on till 10.
All right.
You were the girl that came on at 10 to let the other girl off. You'd see, for her breakfast. So that was the way it worked. And then Sunday, you worked 8 hours in the morning or 8 hours in the afternoon, and the same with your day off. You had the day off from 2 o'clock, the 2 hours, and then that was your day off. Don't tell me about it. And this was supposed to be, I went back years after to see, but it was all knocked down. But the up part of the street was still there, and there was a woman came out the door, and she stood looking at me. And I said, "You're looking at me, I am." She says, "You're kind of familiar." Well, I said,
"She knew your face."
She must have knew my face. I said, "I used to work naming the place," and she said, "Wasn't he a saint?" I said, "Was he?" "Yes," she says. "He went to 6 o'clock mass every morning." I said, "That's right. I was a saint," and I started to laugh. I couldn't help it. You see, the people were very poor, and there was a small loaf, you know, those small batch loaves that's all crushed on the top and bottom,
yeah,
and none on the sides.
Yeah.
He would sell a half of that loaf, you see. If a woman gave him threepence, he would give a half of a loaf. But the price of the loaf was fivepence halfpenny, you see. So he made an extra halfpenny if he sold two halves. Do you understand?
Yeah.
I thought he was a saint. He was a saint on the right side. It was his own side. So then I left there, I got away, and I left there, and I went up, and I got a nice wee shop up in Baggot Street, and that was lovely. And the people again, you have no idea how, nobody has any idea how poor the people were. Really, really poor, and the rations were so little, and there was a big police barracks beside us, 52 policemen, and you talk about 6 foot, 1.5, some of them were 6 foot, 6, and 1 egg in the week, and 2 ounces of butter in the week, and 1 ounce of tea, and the bread, the crust was grand, but if you opened the crust, you could take a handful of bread like that and do that with it, and you could throw it like a football and it would stick to the wall. That's not a lie. I did it. And anyhow, there was this woman came in, and the creature, she used to be a teacher, but everybody lost their job when they went. You know, got married. And
yeah,
she was married to a man, now I can't tell you any names, it wouldn't be right, but he originally was an international rugby player.
Oh.
and she was a teacher, but they had been then on to their 50s, and they were just on social security or whatever the dole that time, and the much dole you got that time was 4 shillings a day, and you had to go and collect it, make sure you weren't working. And he was on the docks unloading ships, but the man would come out. I lived to see this happening years after that. The man would come out and stand on an onion box, and he would pick this man and that man and the other man and that man, and then who was left moved to the next ship, and he would pick again. And this man rarely, if ever, got any work. And then he had to come up then and queue till 10 o'clock. He went out in the old time, he went out to work, was at 4. And he queued then to 10 o'clock to get the 4 shillings dole, before the dole office didn't open till 10 o'clock. And then he would come home, and sure, he was killed out. And later, many years after that, I was down in Wicklow. My sister had a place down there, and I was getting a lift up to Dublin early to get the 9 o'clock train home. And didn't I see the docks on the other side? And didn't I see this happening? I saw the man picking the men. Now, that was many, many years after that, many years. And later on in life then, several more years, I was here, and the woman next door but one said if she had people to stay, could I keep? I said, certainly, I had plenty of space. And she sent this man, and he was a lorry driver. And I was telling him this story, and why this man, I couldn't understand why. He was the bones of a good man, like, I mean, if he got work to make up his muscles, he was a fine man. Why he never got work. And the man, the lorry driver from Limerick, told me, oh, did you not know? He says, the man was picking them would ask for a light, and he should have given the box of matches like that and say, oh, keep them. And then he would have got a job. I said, for a box of matches? Oh, no, he said, there'd have to be a 10 shilling note on the bottom of the matchbox.
That's the way it was worked.
But this poor woman, God help her, she used to get her clothes out of the pawn on a Friday, because she would get some money and she would get her clothes out of the pawn, she would dress up and go away, and she would come back drunk. She would come back drunk, and to get past the police station she used to sing, "We love the green flag with a harp of gold, and our country will never deny that no other flower can take its place, we'll cherish it till we die." And then she'd be passed. I can't sing, so I have to say it. She'd be passed, and then she'd turn around, she'd "dirty, dirty big flat-footed country," and she would scold them.
But she would get by.
She would get by, but then you see, when there'd be a new station sergeant, he wouldn't know about her, so he'd go out and arrest her, and then all the rest of them would laugh at him. The fun was so simple, and yeah.
It was a simple life.
Well, that woman came in to me one day, and this is why I brought this story on, not those little bits. The hailstones were transparent on the ground, and they were quite thick. They weren't white, they were grey, you know, that kind of transparent hailstones. And this woman came in and said, "Those canvas slippers are not made now, like with heels on them, but there were no soles in them." Right? And she had a black coat with 3 safety pins in it. And she said, "Miss Mac," I was MacFadden when I was single. She said, "Miss Mac, would you give me a loaf?" She had a good accent because she was a teacher. "Would you give me a loaf?" "Ah, ha, ha," says I. "Sure, I was only a young thing. I have no loaves." I said, "They're not mine. I can't give them to anybody." And she opened the middle safety pan and she said, "Miss Mac, I have nothing." And there was nothing on under the black coat, either up or down. And I thought, God, this is terrible. But I was getting 7 and 6 pence a week that time.
Mm, you were doing fine.
Oh, horses, hairs back. So I reached back for my purse and I took out the sixpence and I said, "There you are now, Mrs. Not naming that. Buy yourself a loaf." And I gave her the loaf and she gave me the sixpence and I gave her the halfpenny change. And tears in her eyes, she said, "Miss Mac, you'll never want." And I never did. And that's the truth. I never did. Switch off now for a wee while till we have a drop
right,
of soup.
My who? Mr. Josephine, the Matula Reasoning, Sue Bresh and all. Interesting, Mr. Josephine, dog, you get your knees. Rush of Canting Gaelic.
Well, hello, when you can't Gaelic, you heard of me. I had a can't Gaelic. And I guess agus bhí me dig fólam car ágal. Agus in sin hennig an ghéfhanta ma, agus ma wehe hasi sise a lóod gélig, leh gélig an leh bérle. Agus dyrit si agor ma, góma ha nesig stúrstia alta mona, agus an dárne ua rábert si góma a nes an teg an a bórdna torf. Agus am ele a góma ha nes an tórstia the eggs and the nest egg. And don't take in the nest egg, take in the eggs, but don't take in the nest egg. And Shannon Doy a Lord Mudinian Gaelic, a Gusnura Hennig and Kigaris to Scala, Fur Mud and Gaef on the Elig. A Gus Jeffrisha, Dom Yerifer, Gadi, Dagan to Weha, Sinead Nuravish, Stihna Avaha, a Gus Shisha of Era, a Gusan La, a Ravishan with a Dolum me. Yerfa of air and tenum of the air and nest eggs and that.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Den Tahran sin, agus Jeffrey sé dá meise chuar a basta wethe, agus dúirt meise drem na chuiliú, agus ancan ceigeire ar an muiste agus chuir sé sin trí an cean me sin tá, agus am eile bhí mé chorfa ní bliana dé agus ní bliana an sin agus Jeffrey sé tú an Cognac agus an Lóni agus an Blá agus an all fydwyd y sian, ie. Agus fwy'n mwyd yn gyrraeg yn lleg, ie, fwy. So sian mae ta. Yn gydig ala beth o'n meich smwyd i'w ddw.
Ta'n rhaid sy'n gael o'r cestiad yn ysbeth o'n teip sy'n rhaid o'r rhaid, so cael mei ar y hart o'r wymwyd i'w bod. Bydd o'n dwi'n siad i'w taringrad colwm tyllio gyd. If you want to change to English, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But you have his prophecies, colwm tyllio's.
Yes, yes, he said, he did say that for a lot of things, he said, in his writing and his confessions, he said that England would be punished for her cruelty. And he said, the way you will know when the time is coming, to see it happen, that the Tilbury would be gone, and the shipbuilding would be gone, and the last thing to go would be Threadneedle Street, which would be the Bank of England. So that's what one of the things St. Colum Kill said. And he also said, twice, I think, that Ireland would be the finest country on the face of God's earth to live in. Yeah, he did say that. He did write that. It would be the finest country on the face of God's earth. And it seems to be that it's happening now, but there are people, I'm afraid, a lot of them, not them all, are forgetting about Colum Kill and different people like that. And there is a turris and garden, and you can...
Have you done the turris?
Oh, I've done the turris, oh yeah.
Lysha Josephine, are you late because I'm still from turris,
Colin,
can you?
Well,
change to English.
Change to English, yes, better because it's quicker. You do a lot of prayers. There's an old church there that was there a long time ago. It's just a wall steads now. And you go to the church and...
That's in Garton.
That's in Garton, near the well. St. Colum Kill's well, and you could pray a certain amount of prayers around the outside of the church walking. Then you go inside the church and you do a certain amount of prayers inside the church walking, and then you walk down to the well and you see a certain amount of prayers going down there, and then you walk around the well and you say very special prayers around the well three times, and then you kneel down and lift a bottle of water. Now there was a tale or story supposed to be that there was a special trout in that well with a mark at the back of its head, and that some people would see it and some people would not. And I didn't meet anybody who ever saw it. But when I was 14 years of age, it was very exciting to get riding a bicycle. So my sister had a bicycle and she was down home, and I was sent to Garton, to the people who lived near Garton, to bring out socks for the men. My mother used to knit socks, a sock every day along with doing her work. It was no problem for her to do that. She could knit without looking at it, and she would have the two socks the right length without measuring them at the heel. And that is true. And then I was sent out with three pairs of socks, and do the tourist when you're out. So I wasn't sure of the tourist, so I did as many prayers as I could, and then I did round the well, and I knelt down to lift a bottle of water. And there was my little trout come scooting out on one side and swimming right across over to the other, and went in under a flaggy rock on the other side, and I couldn't believe it, because it did have the mark behind its head, and it was a very small trout, about not much more than 7, at the most 8 inches long. So that was that, I saw that, so I really understand now that all the things that said about Colum Kyll and about his prophecy and about his all his work in Ireland and the many things he said, all true. And, let's see what else. Yes, well, after Colum Kyll then, shall I go on?
Yeah.
But, the drowning, no? No.
Yeah, if you want to.
Well, no, it's not necessary, I don't think it's...
Right, well, go back to your work. No, you spent many years working in the north.
Oh, just six months I spent working in the north of Ireland.
Right.
And from there I went to Dublin. Did I told you about
Dublin,
that?
Yeah.
Told you about that? Well, when I was finished in Dublin then, I came home and I was at home for a while. My father was sick. And then my sister was working. She had trained for poultry down in Knockmagarum, poultry farm, County Kildare. And then she got a job in the north as well, working with an exporter of poultry exporter and a pig buyer and everything, a very nice man. And there was their daughter was married in another town, a town village in Tyrone, so they had nobody to do the shop because she married him and then she went to live with him, so they sent for me and I went and did the shop for a while, some merry month, and then it was VE Day and they all went on their holidays and they left me in charge and I've done that fine. And then I did the shop and I did the house and I taught the woman how to make Indian bread and things like that, you know. And then the next thing was there came a job vacant in the Chrysler Co-op. So then my mother sent a telegram to say for me to come home to do the exam. And the woman in the house said, the young daughter said, oh, we'll say the rosary that you don't get it. And the mother said, well, we'll say the rosary that you do get it. And another one says, we'll not say the rosary that night at all, so there'll be no row about it. And I came home anyway, and there were 13 girls to do the exam. And some of them had 5 years secondary education, where I left school at 14 years of age. But I had the experience of the business in Dublin for a while. So I did the exam, and it so happened that I got it. And it was cross tots, and I never heard of the word cross tots. That means a page of sums where you add them up and down, and then you add every line across, and that's it. So it was a lot of money, every kind of money, thousands of pounds and farthings and everything all mixed up. So I was only 2 shillings out in that answer, so that wasn't so bad. So I got the job anyway, and I worked there then for 6 years downstairs, grocery, provisions, a little bit of drapery, and... it was after the war and things were very scarce and people was picking the eyes out of me for wool. You get wool to knit and there was no wool. And we went to Lough Derg, myself and my sister and another lady, and we were coming home and she wanted to go into McGee's Donegal, the wholesalers, and what did I see in there? Only plenty of bunion wool, four ply and double knitting and thicker stuff. So I said how much it was, and they told me, and I said, is it all for sale? Yes. And how much can you buy, as much as you want? I said, I'll take it all. And I took the whole thing, and I filled up the well of the shop, and I was nearly destroyed. I was told, you bought it, so you sell it or else. So I bought it anyway, and everybody was mad. So I cleared everything else off the back side of the shop, and then built up the way it was in the place. And everybody came in, asked the same questions I did. Is that wool? How much is it? Shilling an ounce. I said, for sale, yes. How much can you buy? As much as you want. And the managers told me, sell it or else. So I was wanting to get it sold, so got it sold. And it was we were away for the weekend, so it was Monday. And the wool was in when I went in on Tuesday morning, and there it was. So then the following Sunday, not the following Sunday, but the Sunday after that, not 2 weeks, and the manager had been to visit his aunt, and he said, my aunt said, would you please keep her 8 ounces of the wool, Josephine? And I said, oh, I'm very sorry, Brian, wool is all sold. and that is true. Less than 2 weeks. So that was the beginning of that. So then there was more drapery needed in the village, so then we started up on the upstairs. I started drapery up there, and then I did the shoes and the carpets and the wallpaper and all drapery, coats and everything else. Had customers from actually all over the world, and it was very interesting. And then after 11 and a half years of time, it was time to get married. So I got married then, and my husband was working in England. He had worked in the co-op for 10 years, but £5 a week wasn't enough to keep to, so we went to England, and it was a little bit better there, but not all that much when you paid so much for rent and for rooms, and very, very hard to get a room in London. And you would see a place that you could live in, and they might have a bed sitting room and a kitchen and a bathroom, and then down at the bottom it said no coloured or Irish, so you couldn't ask that there because you were Irish and you weren't there long enough to put on an English accent. And the next thing then was, it got worse then for a while, no dogs coloured or Irish. And you tried on and saved on, and I went to work for a little while, and I did stock control and lines, and that was very interesting because in there they had the very first computer that ever came into the British Isles, and it was called Leo Lions Organized. Oh, forget what the last thing was for, but it was the size of a good big bedroom, and I just got to see it once, but only a people we weren't supposed to go in because I was only doing stock control, and it was all just plug in all around. The whole room was computer. So that was that. So then what would I do then? I used to have my work done very early, and then I used to scan the papers for a house, and then you'd go looking for houses to buy, a little house or a big house or a wee house, whatever you could get. But anyhow, you would be amazed when you go to look for houses in London. Some of them would be so grand you couldn't buy them, they were so expensive, and other ones looked so good from the outside. But one in particular I shall never forget. I went in. The lady was out shopping, and the lady next door said she'd be along presently. So I said, okay, I'll wait. And the lady came along. She had the most beautiful mink coat and diamond and gold earrings in. This is not a lie. And she said, oh yes, the house is for sale. You come in. And she walked in and follow me, she said. And how could I follow her? Because the shape of her was in all the cobwebs along, and she was smaller than me. And I had to go sideways to go in because I couldn't explain it to you. It was all cobwebs. You wouldn't see the walls and the shape of her and the thing. So I went on, and anyway, I thought we could soon clear it out of that. So I went in, but it was no good. We couldn't have it. But the air raid shelter was still in the garden, and that's the way London was. Very grand and very beautiful and very awful.
Very expensive.
And the pay, I remember, without overtime was £14 a week for normal 40-hour week. That wasn't a lot of money.
And what years now?
Let me see, 59. Mm-hmm. Went in 58. Well, it could have been 58. No, it was 59 at that stage. And then I had a daughter. And I went to a place where there was a flat going with the job, and it was a shop, opened the shop in the morning and named the papers and give the papers out to the paper boy, and then closed the shop at night. And that was fine, and it went on very well, and I had my pram and all bought, and there was plenty of space, a very, very big bedroom come living room, no, the kitchen was the living room, and it was very grand, and very, very big room with two big wonders and then two more wonders on the side, and it was ample space, and it was lovely, and it was dead opposite Olympia, very central and very nice. And the Queen would go in to see the the Ideal Home Exhibition, and she would go in to see the dairy things would be in there, so she would pass by now and again. But the day I came home from hospital, the manager, it was his wife who owned the business and the whole house, and he called me and he said, unfortunately, you can't stay here now because the pram would interfere with the burglar alarm in the back hall. So I used to come down the stairs, out the hall and round, and open the shop and go back around the same way again. There was no entrance to the upper, from the shop to the upper premises. So that was a business then. I had to carry my daughter from place to place looking for a room, and sorry, no children allowed, and this went on. But finally we got a nice room down in Cumberland Road where Christine Keeler lived. But she moved on with Perfumo after that. That was a big thing that happened. And then from Leicestermore we got a lovely flat in Edith Road, and from there we got a house, and then my husband's brother came to live with us, so we had him, and then my husband had another brother living in Letterkenny, and he would say to them when the students were looking for jobs for the summer, "I'll go to Johnny, he'll keep you, Johnny and Josephine will keep you." And they came and they came and they came till their house was busting at the seams, and I thought that we would be chased for overcrowding. And that is the truth. But anyhow, there were some of them very nice, and now one of them, I might as well tell you the truth, is a judge. And he is a very, very nice man. He deserves to be a judge. And another one of them wanted to be a teacher, and he couldn't get through here, and he went to England. He worked for 2 years, and then he got a grant to be a teacher, and I was teaching in Derry. And when my husband died, he came out from Derry a week after it, and with his 5 children with him. I thought that was nice. And what else? Oh, there's a lot of things. That's London. London was fine. London was all right, but I used to get there, and I had twin boys after I had the eldest girl. I had twin boys, and I would get them to bed, and after they were 4 years, I had twins again, a boy and a girl. So I had 5 children under 7, and it was very hard to split yourself, for one wanted to go to the morning pictures, another wanted to go to ballet dancing, another wanted to go to the scouts, and there you were. So I thought, I was listening to the radio one night at 10:45, and Michael McLemore was reading Rain on the Wind. It was a book by Walter Mackin, upbeat Donegal Town, or up that way. And I listened to it, and it was all Donegal things were on. And I thought, this is wrong. I shouldn't be here. I'm depriving my children of their birthright, and I'm going to take them home. And it was like telepathy. My husband said that night when he came home, "You think, Joe, we think we should try and go home." And it was so funny. That happened anyhow. And then from there on, we sort of set our sail or our gear with the end being Donegal. So we came home in 1970 when the eldest was 11 and the youngest was 4.5. And we're home since. And
back to the homes of Donegal.
Back to the homes and the hills of Donegal. And I used to love to hear the hills of Donegal sung on the wires. And I used to hear Gay Byrne. And sure, I thought Gay Byrne was a big, strong man. And I couldn't believe it when I saw him. He was a nice, light little fella. But he was Ireland and London. And I used to hear him on the radio. And then we took home the television. And I thought, this is no good. We'll sit watching television. So I told the children that television doesn't work here. And doesn't work. It didn't work because it wasn't plugged in. So
Hardy Walker wasn't plugged in.
No, but then the thing about it was, you see, if I let them sit and watch the programs they were used to watching, they would never get accustomed to Donegal and running up here and running up there.
So you bought this place when you came across it?
This was already bought before we came. Then we had arranged that, but it was a wall stead, you know, it was, and you could see from one room into the other. So I stayed with my brother up in Dremiathan for a year, and well, we came home in July, and we stayed up there. I wanted to be down for the boys' 10th birthday, which was on the 10th of April. So my husband and his brother worked steadily, constantly repairing the house from July until the end of April, and it wasn't quite finished then, but there was enough to do. And then he didn't settle very well then. There was no work, and he went back to England for 6 months, and he came back again, and he went back again for 6 months, and that wasn't that wasn't just the thing, the family, so it was no good. So I said, "We'd put down your name on with Farth up in Ballybuffet," that was the nearest one, and he did. And one day, a lady came to the door, and she said, "Is your husband looking for work?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Would you tell him to report in Letterkenny in the morning?" And that was him then. He worked on Court Halls, the new hospital, the new post office, and Eamon. I worked there then until he retired. And then he retired, and he was only 17 months retired when he died. Very, very suddenly. He walked in, and he was dead in 2 minutes. Because I have habit of looking at the clock. And he came in between 4:20 and 4:15, and he was dead at 4:00. So that's my rest in peace. And then from there on we carried on as best I could. I had already started, had I started a shop? Yes. I started a little drapery shop here because the premises was big enough to do it in, or I should say in which to do it. And when the children, the smallest two, were almost 10, I thought I'd start then. And I was 50, and they were almost 10, so if I was in the shop and they were able to make a cup of tea themselves. So that was fine. They'd done very well at school, and four of them went to college and went through university, and one of them finished at secondary school. Before he did his leaving, he came home and asked me would I sign this for him to go to work, and they didn't say how long, month or year, so I signed it. It was ESB, so he's with ESB since. And he was away in France when they had the big storm from years ago, and he had a great time in France. And then when he came back, he was on Marion Finucane on the radio, and he told Marion Finucane all about it. And now he's still with ESB, and he does different things now altogether. He doesn't go up the poles or anything like that anymore. And he misses that because he was an outside boy. He liked outside. And the eldest girl then, she went on to do nursing, and she went to do it in Altnagalvin and the new University of Ulster, and she did the degree course, and she did it in 4 years. And then she went to Scotland, she did a midwifery, and then she went to Zimbabwe and worked in Zimbabwe near Harare for 2 years. And then she came home, and she was home a very short time when she went to do back to university to do the public health course for a year and a half. And then she did that, and she went on and on and on, and she had something else now again, still with the health board. And who else? William then, he was interested in the pictures, and he went to I shouldn't be telling this on this, should I? No, this is not. Well, he went to college, and he did the history of English and the history of art, and he's working in the RHA in Dublin, and he worked in Cork UCC, and he worked in Dublin UCD, and he worked in Trinity College Dublin as an outside lecturer, and he does all that, and now he just does his own work, and what did they call it there? Not NCAD, his wife works in NCAD, and they're very happy, and they have no children. Dolores has no children, but Anthony has three beautiful girls, Shauna, Lisa and Jessica, and one nicer than the other, and you couldn't know which is the best. They're lovely girls. And then my daughter Aunt Cork, she went to college in Cork, and she did English and music, and then she did another full music, and then she worked a whole lot of places in Cork. And then her husband got married to a Cork man, and then they went to California for 5 years, and I was out there 3 times, and I saw a lot of stuff, and that would make another day's telly to tell all that. And she came home again, and after a long wait, she had a lovely baby daughter when she was in America. And then when they were at home a year or so, she had a baby son. So they're 6 and 3 now, and that's just great. And she's not 6 yet until January, but she's 5, and then he's 2 past, and whatever anyway. And then another son, Sean, he went through college as well, and he went away to Japan, and he married a Japanese girl, and they have one daughter, and he comes home every so often, and he wrote a book, a geisha girl, a lovely book. And then he wrote a short history of India, and then he's writing another book now about the male geisha, and then he teaches English as well out there. And here I am now, sitting in Chrysler after the last time I am. Along with me here, 1970, 36 years, and I'm very happy, and I'm very well, thanks be to God. A little bit's a problem, but nothing to worry about. And that's my story.
Yes. You tell me briefly about your drapery shop.
Well, my drapery shop.
Yeah, the customers came from all over.
Customers were wonderful. They were out of this world. And the woman next door, as I told you, had asked me to keep people. And one man came in because his mother and father was able to stay with Miss McColgan, but he came in to me. And where was he from? Only from South America. He was an Irish man who wanted to have a jetty someplace, and he couldn't find, I forget what he wanted to do, but he wanted to have a jetty with boats coming in and out, and he couldn't find one, and he went right on along up from Wexford, Waterford, on up along till he went away up to Northern Ireland, and he found a place there that he could make a jetty. But they pulled out the stuff and they started to dig, the water was deep enough and thing, and what did they discover? Only salt. And he made his jetty and he's exporting salt all over the world, he told me. And he was very happy because I had a trout for his breakfast and he didn't have a trout for 10 years, he said. So that was one, and that was nice. And then in the shop then there was two ladies came in. They were living in a senior citizen's home, and one of them was very nice and the other was nicer, and they had the lady from the home with them, and it transpired that one of them was a buyer in a big shop, I forget the name of it, in Sucker Hall Street in Glasgow, and the other lady was a seamstress for the Kennedy family in America. Imagine that. And she was from the west of Ireland, West Donegal, and I enjoyed those two very well. And oh, there were so many people. There were three German people came in one time, only one had English, and they wanted Shetland wool sweaters, and I questioned them where they come. They came to London and they went up the west coast and they went up to Scotland, and then they come over to Ireland to the south, and they went round Killarney, and they came up and they were coming round here, and they come in here for sweat. And I said, why did you not buy sweaters when you were in at the Shetlands up there in Scotland? And they said, oh, come here, recommend. And I thought, this is great. I had already sold the year before a few to some Germans, so they were recommended to come here. Well, I thought there was something very wrong with the company in Cork that was making them, that they couldn't export them. And the company sold themselves out now, and they're not there anymore. And there was a market in Germany for Shetland wool, and nobody ever bothered about it. No, it was very foolish. So that was that, but I enjoyed that, and different people then. A nephew came one day, and it was Christmas Eve, and he said, he rang me up, I'm bringing Sam, and I didn't know who Sam was. So Sam came, and they all sat down to the Christmas dinner, and Dolores was away from home for the first time, and she was working in a hospital in Dublin. And she was finished on Christmas evening. And when the Christmas dinner, the main course was finished, my son said to Anthony Byatt, Aunt Sam, were you ever in Dublin? No. Well, he said, he pushed the plate over like that. He said, we'll get the dessert when we come back. And he says, we'll go now. And they went out and they took her home, and they had her home in Dublin, her home in Donegal and Chrisley before Christmas was over. I can't see him yet, I'm like pushing the plate, and it was so frosty that the bus went round in a spin on Ballygalway round about the bus span round there. So anyway, those are things that I remember. And when working in the shop, then there were the travellers, and they were very interesting. Travellers were very interesting because each one was a completely different person wrapped up in the and skin, you know. They were completely different thinking, and some of them were very businesslike and very looking forward. And then there was one man who was a very nice little man, and he didn't come for a long time, and he was working for a big firm. And I said, where were you? Oh, he said, I was very ill, I was in hospital, I haven't been long taken away. What happened? He said, for 10 years, he said, I had a piece of a peanut in my lung. He said, it went with my breath. He said, you should never give children or young people peanuts because they're so light they go with their breath. And he had half of his lung taken away, one of his lungs. So that was an interesting thing. So that,
you just love meeting people, and
I do,
a blooming trade as well. Like.
I had a very good business. I really had it.
And people came from Tory even, you said?
Oh, they came from Tory, surely to God, and they came from all over. And those trousers that you would get for old men with the wee two peaks at the back for the braces, you know, nice heavy wool in them. Because old men's legs get cold, and I'll tell you something else, old ladies' legs get cold too. I find that now. The knees, and it was down to the last pair, and a lady came from away past Milford, away out that way, and she said she wanted trousers for her father, and I said, I doubt they're all gone, I have only one pair, and they won't be big enough. He was a very stout man because he was sitting for a long time. And Not at all, worry, she says, I'll put a piece on the back. She says, in the back of the old one, she says, I'll put a piece on the back of the legs, was never, I'll put a piece on the back.
She bought them?
She bought them, yes, and that was the last pair I never saw any more since. The wool, the material used to come in from Germany, and it would be made in Drogheda. And they were sold all around the country. Well, then the men started, I suppose, to get not so old anymore, and they would wear just the ordinary trousers. And then there was so many different things. There was other material used to come in from Germany, and I suppose it didn't come in anymore when Courtauld started making it. But there was in Ballybofey there was a factory, and they made gym slips for women, kimonos like gym slips, and skirts and slacks. And honest to goodness, they were so good, people just loved them. And that was one thing that went off the market too. And then they got a new designer there, and they changed the name, and stuff became very, very expensive. So that I was middle of the road stuff, ordinary stuff, just anything for children. Like, nobody would be stuck, anybody would get something if they had to go in a hurry any place. There were always something there to fit them, only I didn't keep shoes. And one man said, and you sell socks and you don't sell shoes, that's no good. I didn't have space for shoes. Another man came, he was a little man, and he came from over by Carrigart, and he came to live over this way, and he came, I'd just come down for a grape. And well, I says, I don't have grapes. And you have a shop and you don't have grape.
You thought you'd buy everything in the
Well, like the cope, you know, and everything, that everything should be there. So that was that. And it was very good. And then the VAT came, and that was very difficult. And you would buy stuff and the VAT would be added on, and then you had to get the VAT, and you had to put that price of the VAT onto the thing before you priced it. And it was kind of awkward, but we managed. And well, let's see what else. Can't remember anymore.
Well, you've done most of it, haven't you?
I've done most of it. That was that. And then, as I say, I told you that my brother got Alzheimer's, and I took him down, and he was here, and I had the shop, and then I got a heart attack, and then I sold out the shop. And now somebody approached me, an official approached me with a letter for a cheap shop, for a pound shop, and I said, no, too much noise, I'm tired with all that. And then another person came and said, letter for an office, and I said, yes, I will, and it's a fast office now.
So you're rented out.
So I rented out now, and I have no bother at all.
That's
your husky. Mr.
Josephine, instead of three
auntie, oh, yeah, we should go to America. I guess, kind of when Mary, she went first, and she got engaged to a man called, strangely enough, Paddy McHugh. And he would be a distant relation of my mother's, who was McHugh. And he was reared in my mother's home. And she got engaged to him. And how you got engaged in those times was the gentleman bought you a gold chain and put the wedding ring on the chain, and you wore it inside. That was how you got betrothed, it was the name of it. And while she was wearing this, she began to think, and she began to think, and she decided really and truly that she wouldn't get married. She would like to be a nun. And she gave him back the ring and the chain, and he said, no, 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 it's yours, you can do what you like with it, you don't have to marry me, that's fine. But she says, I can't go into the convent with a chain around my neck with a ring on. Well, he said, why don't you send it to your father, it'll do one of his your sisters. So that's exactly what happened, and it was sent to my father, and I did the next daughter, who was Grace. And Grace got married, and must go back a wee bit here now. Before Grace was born, the habit in those times was the first daughter went to their mother's place to have their first baby. That was the habit. So Grace's mother, that would be my grandmother, went down to Portnabra to have her first baby, and her first baby was Grace. But while she was being born, there was a sea captain in, big ship was out in the bay, and he came in on a small boat to buy the provisions. And he heard the cry of a new baby, and he said, is that a new baby? And they said, yes. Well, they said, I'll give you 100 gold guineas for that baby. And wait a minute, my granny said, well, no, it wasn't the granny, it was her aunt that she went down to, well, you have to ask the mother of the child. So I went down to ask my granny, and she said, she's not for sale. And he came back, and the baby was washed in, and the water was thrown out to the bathtub, and the basin in which she was bathed, he opened his dirty bag, and he dumped the whole bag of gold into the thing, that for her. And they said no. And the thing was, he was a sea captain. He was away from London for 2 years. He was coming home when the ship was coming in. The gold was only part of it. And his wife had no child. He had a wife on the ship and had no child. And he wanted to come home with a new baby. And the baby wasn't sold. So that's all right then. When that baby was born, that was my Auntie Grace that got married with a ring from the nun. When she was having her first baby, she came up to the Mason, which was her home, to have her first baby. And her great-granny, my great-granny, was out on the street, and it was only 2 years ago who I found who this old woman was. She was out on the street walking about, murmuring and grumbling away to the stars. And she was doing astronomy, and she talked away to the stars and rumbling away, and Gaelic and Gothic and Chen 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 and Chen. She said, thanks and praise be to God, a priest is born tonight. And then she went. And there was a wee boy right enough. And it turned out that this wee boy was Father Barney Gallagher over in Galway. And he was a priest. And when he was 12 years old, he used to come up to my home where his mother, where he was born. And my mother asked him, he was a bright boy, would you like to be Gracie or every different name?
The Western.
The Western, no. And he was running ashes with a stick. He was playing in ashes with a stick because he had a donkey and a saddle and the whole gear. And he was 12. And she said, finally, she said, would you like to be a priest? And he said, looked up and said, Vienna, by Kvart. I would be wild to be a priest. Mm-hmm. So that was him, and that was that story. Well, that was Auntie Mary and Auntie Gracie. Auntie Rosha went to America too, and she went with dementia, or whatever you call it, Alzheimer's, and she wouldn't tell you anything sensible at all. When she was old, she was 90, and she would tell you all about America. And Mrs. Chu, did you see Mrs. Chu today? No, she's gone to Florida. And she would tell us all about Mrs. Chu, and then, what about the carpets? Oh, sure, we had to call on the men. We couldn't do carpets like that at all, and ceilings. We had to have men in to do that. They had to be all done when Mrs. Chu comes back from Florida. And she would tell you all about it. And then, how much of the eggs I used to ask her, what's your eggs to you? Oh, the eggs, threepence a dozen. And where do you sell them? Where would I sell them? Only in Barney McGinley's, my cousins. And that was Auntie Rosha. And she went down to Auntie Gracie. They took her down there to Auntie Gracie Derry Fad when she got old, and Auntie Gracie was sick. And the doctor was there with Auntie Gracie. And Auntie Rosha was never sick. She was very well, tall and slim. They were all tall and slim. And the doctor said Auntie Gracie was waiting for her to come out of the room where Auntie Gracie, Auntie Rosha was waiting. And she said, excuse me, doctor, how is my granny this morning? Oh, he said, GC, let me out of here. She thought it was her granny, do you know what I mean? Right. So that was that story. And then my uncle also went to America, my father's only brother, Uncle Pat. And he was there in the Depression in 1929. And it was very, very bad. And my Auntie Mary was a nun, and her job was going out. She was teaching the girls deportment and etiquette and how to behave when they went to abroad, to France or France for their finishing touch. They went in, and she said then that when she wasn't doing that, she went out begging. And the people who would best was beg was the people that had nothing. They would give her something, and then they cooked up for the men that had nothing, and they came to the back door of the convent and they fed as many men as they could.
The men would come to the back door.
They would, because there was no work. You see, when the crash came, it was a terrible crash in 1929, and everybody lost everything. And
nobody had work nor money.
There was nothing to pay them. Nothing to pay them. And there was a lady in our town, and she was working in a big house, and stoker for the fires, died. And she was the laundress. She was washing and ironing. And she said, if you give me has pay, I'll do the stoking too. And she did. She was a beautiful wee woman. And she did the stoking and that, and she came home and died at home. And that's all, that's about that. I'm sure I forgot something else. Oh yes, about isn't that a good one about the Auntie Gracie?
Oh, that's funny.
That is, yeah, true. He wanted to buy it, and that was true. Yeah. And that's down there, passport, you know, the hotel, Marble, no. Shandon, over the way over there. That was where my, and then for a priest in that house too, Father McIntyre, and he was known in the and the county and the diocese as the gentleman. He never mentioned money off the altar. He would say that a new school have to be built and such have to be done, and it was paid. And then he said, "Thank you all very much." He said, "The school's built now," or whatever.
He wouldn't spend money.
No, all we collected, but he wouldn't speak about it. He wouldn't say give it or not give it. The people give it. They knew that all the rest of the priests called him the gentleman because he wouldn't talk about money. And leave it off now for a minute again till we see. Well, whatever you think, switch it off for a minute.